Welcome to the Interesting Football Podcast. My name's Laurie Knox, and I'm joined by former University of Central England six-a-side Football League winner, Simon Day. This week, we'll be discussing whether Leicester City are the most interesting team in the English Premier League. Simon Day, how are you, and what are your first thoughts when somebody says Leicester City?
I'm okay, and I think, like most people in the country, my first thoughts when I hear Leicester City are all about their title win 5 years ago. I think that's...
Of course.
I mean, I'll go on a limb here and sort of excluding my own sort of personal experiences watching Gillingham, that is the most interesting thing that's happened to football in my lifetime.
Is it the most is it the most unlikely victory ever?
In sport? Yes.
Okay, in all of sport?
Yes, because the only comparables are one-offs. So you could say James Buster Douglas beat Mike Tyson. Yeah, that's unbelievable. But that's heavyweight boxing, isn't it?
Two horse race as well.
It's a two horse race. Both horses are huge and can knock someone out with one punch. Yeah. And there's stuff like, obviously, the 81 Ashes. Everyone talked about the Botham's Ashes. Yeah, remarkable turnaround. But it was just a couple of days. I suppose in more recent times, Emma Raducanu's probably the biggest of recent times. That was a remarkable thing. But that was like, what, 10 matches she won, give or take.
Right.
There's individual matches, like, I don't know, Japan beating South Africa in the Rugby World Cup. But to do it over a 38-game season when you're 5,000-1 to win and almost got, and we're like halfway through the previous season, you're bottom of the league. I can't think of anything remotely comparable.
I'll throw one in there as something that gets mentioned when you talk about unlikeliest victories. Denmark 92 Euro Championships.
But that was five games.
Indeed. They weren't even in it two weeks before it started, right? So
they were apparently on the beach, weren't they? I don't know how accurate that was, but apparently they were on the beach. And ditto Greece in 04. But again, that was six matches.
I'm always surprised that it's never happened in the World Cup, because obviously in the Euros, okay, Denmark, like you say, there are eight teams in the tournament. So I mean, yeah, okay. But Greece, okay, when the tournament was a bit bigger, okay, it's getting a bit more like it. I'm surprised the World Cup's never had a shock winner, because like you say, you know, you can draw three matches in the group stage and get through, or at least you could. I suppose you probably could just about now. But you just need to really win one game in the groups. You can basically draw the rest of your matches and be good at penalties and win. You know, so you could
get a nice draw. Yeah,
get a nice draw at, like England have done the last couple of tournaments and maybe win two or three matches. I mean, it's some surprise it's not happened, but there we go.
Yeah, well, I guess Croatia at the last World Cup was probably as near as it's been. I mean, they weren't rank outsiders, but I can't imagine many people pegged them as finalists. But I can't think of any other examples. But yeah, Leicester City, the most interesting thing that's happened in my football lifetime.
Right. Leicester, did I mention going to Leicester last week? I think I did, didn't I? And an own goal from 50 yards.
Yes.
Yeah, I couldn't remember if that was on air or off air.
No, I think that was on air. That's pretty remarkable, to be honest. Is that the only time you've been
remarkable,
to Leicester?
Yeah. Football I Spy. That was my only time to what's now the King Power Stadium. I did go to Filbert Street. I remember I hadn't seen Wednesday win for about 3 or 4 years. I saw a nice little 2-0 or 2-1 victory. I seem to remember Wim Jonk scoring. Wim Jonk, that was a strange one, because he, the kind of player, you know, think of joining your team. You think if he joined your team, wow, Wim Jonk, you know, one of the most kind of cultured central midfielders in Europe. He just wasn't really that good.
I remember when Gillingham signed Tommy Johnson in the early 2000s. And for Gillingham, that was a huge signing. We signed Tommy Johnson and Rod Wallace. And that's like for a club like Gillingham.
Rod Wallace went there.
Yeah, that's a coup, isn't it? And they just spent an injury hit season not doing a great deal, to be honest. Well, Wallace scored a few goals. Johnson scored a cracking goal in a big cup win. But yeah, it was a pretty non-event, to be honest. And then a few years later, we signed Steve Lomas, which I thought would be a massive signing, and he was terrible.
In terms of big sign or big names, I remember, okay, so when Wednesday went down to the Premier League and we had quite a few years of not paying any money for players, just being absolutely, just picking up free signings from Northampton, things like that. And then we got one player in, basically if you've heard of him, you get excited, and that player was Francis Jeffers. Didn't quite go to plan, but there we go.
That's still my sort of parameter for is a Gillingham signing good on? Is it a good signing or not? Is have I heard of him? And on that basis, right, the vast majority of our signings over the last 10 years haven't been good signings on that basis.
Right. It is pretty sad when you rate them based on whether you've heard of them. But yeah, I do that too.
In fact, the majority of our inverted commas good signings in the last 10 years have been players that have previously played for us. Hence why I'd heard of them. But yeah, it's pretty poor stuff, to be honest.
And when I went to see Chef Wednesday win 2-0 at Filbert Street, I went to a nightclub the night before and Boy George was playing. There you go. That memory just suddenly bounced into my head out of nowhere.
That's pretty cool.
Okay, Mr. Day, how about fact number one?
Well, fact number one, we've got to have a fact relating to Leicester City's title win, haven't we? And the fact is, Andy King is the only player ever to have won the Premier League title, the Championship title, and the League One title, all with the same club.
That's pretty impressive.
That is impressive, isn't it? We're in a seven-year period. 2009, they won the League One title. About 3 years later, they won the Championship. And in 2016, they won the Premier League.
Damn.
He wasn't a regular. What's so impressive
is it's a fact about football.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually got three facts about football today. It's like I know,
boring.
I know
that's who not cares about football?
Yeah, I know that's not what people want. But he wasn't a regular during the title season. He played 23 games, but a lot of them were sub because N'Golo Kanté was deemed to be better than him. And to be honest, that was as amazing as it was. One thing that went for Leicester that season was they hardly had any injuries. They sort of, certainly the second half of the season, it was exactly the same team every week.
Right.
And I think clearly there's an element of luck involved in that. Not that I'm saying their title win was lucky, because it wasn't at all, but to be able to pretty much name the same team every week is a pretty good position to be in, isn't it?
They also got a perfect storm of, you know, Man U post-Ferguson. Well, yes. I suppose they're still there. Chelsea had one of their kind of transition seasons.
Yes.
I can't remember what happened with Man City at that. But, you know, things just seem to fall into place too. But there we go.
Well, yeah, because for a lot of the season, their nearest rivals were Tottenham. And it's like, you ain't going to fear much from Tottenham being your nearest rivals, are you? Tottenham's... Well, Tottenham were the main challengers all season, but they still managed to finish third.
The Arsenal fans love to say that, don't they? Tottenham are the only team who could finish third in a two-horse race.
Yeah. Arsenal sort of came from nowhere and finished second on the last day of the season. Because actually, Leicester won the league by like over 10 points. They didn't just win the league. They like destroyed everyone. it's mad, really. But
I also, going back onto what we talked about, Arsenal were pipping Tottenham in the end. I love the St. Tottenham's Day thing that they used to do, where, and it just always used to happen, didn't it? Like Spurs could literally be like 15 points above Arsenal with five games left, and Arsenal would still somehow finish above them. It was always good fun.
So St. Tottenham's Day, that's the day when it's confirmed, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the day when it's arithmetically not possible for Tottenham to surpass Arsenal.
That's right. Fantastic. Mr. Day.
Tottenham. I just want to say something about Tottenham. Yeah, just a little bit about Tottenham. I find Tottenham like pitiful. I still find it mad that Tottenham sort of consider themselves to be like a massive club. But the last time they won a major trophy was the game that Paul Gascoigne broke his leg.
Fair enough.
And Gary Lineker missed a penalty. And they haven't won the Cup or League since then.
Wow. Well, Gary Lineker comes up. In fact, Barry Lineker comes up in conversation in a bit.
Barry Lineker?
Yeah. Sounds like one of the. It sounds like, you know, when you play a computer game that's not been licensed, and they have to just slightly change the player names.
We are talking about a video game in the next fact. Weirdly,
well, this is all falling into place nicely. It's almost landed.
Rehearsals went really well,
Mr. Day. Quiz this week. Quick question before we start: how many men have been manager of Leicester City since the turn of the millennium?
17.
24. But this, to be fair, numbers have been boosted by quite a few, what am I trying to say, like temporary managers in there.
Caretakers,
including three guys who a couple of times they just took over just for a match. So triple joint managers. Anyway, you probably guess what's coming next. 24 men have managed Leicester City since the year 2000, since the 1st of January 2000. I'm going to be kind and say you've only got to name seven of the 24. Because you're 4-3 down, so this could get you back up to a level pegging. So, Mr. Day, you've got 1 minute to name Leicester City managers since 2000. Let's go.
Brendan Rodgers.
Yes.
Claudio Ranieri.
That's two.
Craig Shakespeare.
Oh, yes, three.
Claude Puyol.
That's four.
Mickey Adams.
Oh, good one.
Nigel Pearson.
Of course.
Six. Oh, bugger, now it gets harder. Peter Taylor.
Peter Taylor, yes.
Page three, hunk, Peter Taylor. So Peter Taylor, was Neil Lennon in that period, or was he a bit early?
No.
Oh, did he quit before then?
Neil Lennon's manager, though, at Leicester.
He went to Scotland, didn't he?
Five seconds.
Martin O'Neill.
Oh, he's done it. Eight.
Yes.
And there's the buzzer. There's the buzzer. Mr. Day's got it back up to 4-4. Martin O'Neill just at the end. In fact, he quit or whatever happened to him. I think it was June 2000. So he just made the millennium.
Yeah, and then Peter Taylor.
Some other names you missed out there. Dave Bassett.
A couple of times
he was in charge of. A weird one. Howard Wilkinson at one time came in with Dave Bassett to be a caretaker manager for one game. Gary Megson.
Oh yeah, could have got that.
Gary Megson's at Leicester. Gary Megson's story. My favourite Gary Megson story out of all the Gary Megson stories I have was the one where he went for the, because he captained Sheffield Wednesday. His dad captained Sheffield Wednesday, and his granddad used to go and watch Wednesday play. So you know, obviously a family history of Hillsborough, and then he went to interview for the vacant Sheffield United manager's job, and he drove to Bramall Lane, said he parked the car in the in the car park, stared at the stadium for about 5 minutes, and was just like, no, I can't do this, and drove off. So obviously, you know, that's for a Wednesday fan, that's kind of what you want to hear, isn't it? In fact, you know what, I've just suddenly thought about, oh my god, this came out of nowhere, I'm going to admit to a serious crime now. I've shoplifted once in my life. This was in, well, I was either 7 or 8, and I shoplifted Gary Megson. So, do you remember those like football cigarette card things?
Oh, yeah. Not, we're not talking sort of Panini here, are we? We're talking, they weren't for an album particularly, were they? You just collected them.
It was like cigarette candy type of thing, yes?
Yeah.
I don't know what you could, like, it's basically like candy that looked like cigarettes.
Yeah, like cigarette-shaped candy, yeah, basically.
Mm. For the corporates. And they had, like football cards in there. And yes. I think I was in Canterbury. I was in some kind of like Woolworths, WH Smith type shop. And yes, I would have been like 7 or 8 at the time. I just looked around and was like, I wonder which player's in it. And I opened up the box, and it was Gary Megson, who at the time was my favourite Wednesday player. And I looked around and I took the card and I walked out the store. So that my one brush with the law, my career as a criminal was I stole a Gary Megson card of, in 87 or 88. Well, so apologies to the shopkeeper in Canterbury.
Yeah, and thank God the police don't investigate crimes retrospectively, so that you won't be you won't be getting a knock on the door about that one, will you?
Well, statute of limitations, right? Surely that's, you know, that 34 years, I reckon I've got away with that one, haven't I? Absolutely mugged them off. But,
and Woolworths have gone out of business.
Your move, Kent Police. A couple of other managers, just to let you know, Nigel Worthington, Martin Allen.
Sorry, what are we talking about? Oh, yeah, right, okay, yeah.
Ian Holloway. And okay, this one, you won't know. He was one of the three caretaker managers, but I just want to say his name. Sorry. Steve Beaglehole.
Beaglehole?
Yeah, his surname is Beaglehole, one word, yes.
I've 100% never heard of him because I would never forget him. Steve Beaglehole.
You never, and you never will forget Steve Beaglehole now.
Steve Beaglehole?
Later, am I kidding?
I'd love to know the, your word, man. You're surely you can investigate the origins of the Beaglehole family name.
I was thinking that I do a lot of I do a lot of surname etymology, but Beaglehole. I mean, yeah, that one absolutely stumped me.
A couple of things spring to mind, but yeah, I can't imagine they're accurate.
Yeah, you'd hope not. And you know, when you do the, you know, the surname ones, I always say, you know, Johnson, son of John, you know, Richardson, son of Richard, and then you get, you know, the surname Dickinson, which, I mean, you've got to question.
Where did that come from?
Anyways. Steve Beaglehole. Right, Mr. Day, save me. Fact number two.
Fact number two, we'll say fact number three is a corker, but fact number two is that ex-Leicester City goalkeeper Peter Shilton holds the world record for most competitive appearances. Care to have a guess at how many?
World record?
The world record. Care to have a guess at how many competitive appearances?
I was going to say like 1,000.
Well, he's made 1,005 football league appearances.
Mm-hmm.
In all competitive football, he's made 1,390.
Wow.
Now, he was so good as a 16-year-old, and he's so old, that he took over from Gordon Banks as Leicester City goalkeeper after England won the World Cup. In 1966, and they were so high on Shilton that they sold Banks to Stoke City in 1966.
Wow.
And weirdly, a year later, this was 66, he made his debut. He carried on playing until 1997, at the age of 47, when he retired at Leighton Orient.
Wow. My memory of Peter Shilton, when I think about that, when he was considered an old keeper in 91... he still had a few more years in him. When he played for Derby and John Harkes banked one past him from 40 yards.
I can sort of remember the latter days of Shilton, him sort of basically being his age, and it sort of showing when I saw him play that he was getting on a bit. Mm. I mean, even like the 1990 World Cup, that Germany goal in the semi-final, I feel like a more agile goalkeeper would have saved that. The Paul Parker.
The penalty dives.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, the penalty dives were all a bit like, yeah, I mean, yeah. He kind of waited a second after it was kicked and then died. I don't know. The ball's hitting the back of the net and then he dives the direction the ball went in. Yeah.
There was no danger of a save, was there?
No.
But a couple of remarks. So he's still, talking of England, he's still England's most capped player at 125.
I thought Beckham had beaten him, no?
No, Beckham is the most capped. I think he's the most capped outfield player. Beckham.
Ah, okay.
You have to crowbar a record in for Beckham, don't you? But yeah, Shilton still holds it. He also holds the record for the most World Cup clean sheets at 10.
Really?
Yeah. But my favourite two Shilton facts are that in 1967, he scored a goal for Leicester City. He then played for another 30 years and never scored again.
A barren spell.
It's a barren, yeah. That's got to be the longest barren spell in football history.
Yeah.
He's waiting 30 years for his second goal. But also, in 1967, he played against Pat Jennings in a Leicester City game. I'll say he was playing for Arsenal, but I might be wrong. Apologies if I am. They then played against each other 18 years later in an international match.
Wow.
And as far as I can't find any other examples of two players playing against each other more than 18 years apart.
In terms of longevity, one thing that a career I always admire, in fact, you know what, pretty similar. In fact, you say 67 he started. Well, there we go. What year were the moon landings?
69.
The first. Okay, yeah, because I always thought, like, Roberto Duran, he started his career before the moon landings and finished, I think it was a month away from 9/11. But Peter Shilton's outdone Roberto Duran, hasn't he?
Yeah, the boxing. Oh, I've been boxing's a different kettle. Is Roberto Duran fighting a YouTuber next week or something as well? I mean, you know what I mean?
No, I mean, these were legit fights. These were legit fights, yeah. So it's not a. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's like.
Duran, I mean, oh, don't get me started with Roberto Duran. He was a lightweight, absolutely tiny guy. He went up and he almost knocked out a future heavyweight as well. He beat him. Yeah, Roberto Duran's definitely in the running, best ever boxer. But anyway, sorry, we should probably focus on Peter Shilton more than Roberto Duran.
I think we've covered off Peter Shilton very well there. But
what actually was the fact? Because a lot of interesting stuff about Peter Shilton. I've just seen here that his debut, again, this kind of dates him as well. His debut for England was in 1970 against East Germany. What was the actual fact again?
He holds the world record for most competitive football appearances at 1,390.
I can just
remember when I was a kid, like primary school kid, I just assumed Peter Shilton was always in goal for England. There was none of this sort of, do you know what I mean? It was like, it was always Peter Shilton. And I always felt a bit sorry for Chris Woods and David Seaman because they all seemed to be in the England squad, didn't they? But, and sometimes Dave Besson. They're all in the England squad, but they very rarely seem to get a game until after 1990. But yeah, it was just always Shilton in goal, wasn't it?
Chris Woods, who was went especially bad on his second or third year at Wednesday. And this is how bad a manager Graham Taylor was. Kevin Pressman was now Wednesday's first team keeper, and Graham Taylor was still picking Chris Woods for England. Like, remember when England lost in the USA in that kind of weird pre-World Cup tournament?
Well, that was England. That was like a big thing in the press because England didn't qualify for the World Cup, did they? So that was right. That was England's big football of that period. And Alexi Lalas scored, didn't he?
Indeed. Yeah, and Chris Woods. I know that he was getting a lot of abuse at the time. Like I say, he couldn't even get in the Sheffield Wednesday team. But
still in England team.
But this, to be fair, is Graham Taylor, the man who refused to pick Chris Waddle when he won the Football of the Year award. He refused to pick him that year. And in the decisive match away to Holland, played Carlton Palmer right midfield instead.
Yeah, it didn't go well that game either, did it?
It didn't.
It didn't go that well. This was this was around the time Geoff Thomas got his caps, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that
was, 92.
He was one of these, a Taylor pick, wasn't he? I always feel a bit sorry for Geoff Thomas because it's like he got 8 or 9 caps. I think he's clearly a very good midfielder, but all anyone can ever remember about his time playing for England was that miss against France where he tried.
That's all anybody remembers about him, right?
Yeah, I mean,
that's right, because he was through one and one. He was kind of like about 30, 40 yards out, wasn't he? He was through one and one. It's like, okay, keep taking it, Jeff. Take it another 20 yards. Choose a side. But he went to chip him, and obviously the ball just like dribbled pathetically off for a throw-in about 25 yards in front of the goal and obviously to the side of the pitch. So, well, yeah, it was...
It was the classic example, a player just being in a position they never thought they'd be in and just having a complete meltdown and breaking down and just all kind of logic disappearing from their head.
That's a good way to put it. I like that.
Great stuff. Anyway, well done, Peter.
Yes. Right. So that was fact number two. Our bizarre fan for this week is Arnold Dorsey, who was born in Madras, British India. Any idea?
I'll be honest, I'm not as impressed with Arnold Dorsey as I was Vern Troyer.
Fair enough. Arnold Dorsey, who goes by the name Engelbert Humperdinck,
Okay. Yes.
So it turns out Engelbert Humperdinck wasn't his real name. So yes, he's born in what's now Chennai. Am I pronouncing that correctly? What was Madras? Yes. Moved to Leicester at the age of 10. And yeah, spent most of his formative years in Leicester. When Gary Lineker was a little kid, Engelbert Humperdinck used to go around his house or go to the grocery store and play cards with Barry Lineker, the greengrocer and father of Gary Lineker.
Barry and Gary.
And yeah, Barry and Gary.
And wine.
Oh, you know, that kind of winds me up. I just think about men, basically, who name their children after themselves. I just don't like that.
Well, it goes a step further in America, doesn't it? It goes a step further. You get like, there's quite a few.
Sime Day Jr. the fourth.
Yeah, like Odell Beckham Jr., isn't there? And there's a famous golfer, Davis Love the third, wasn't there? The golfer.
Oh, dear.
He's not a bloody monarch, is he? It's like, come on. So yeah, that is ridiculous. But it does beg the question: where did Arnold Dorsey or whatever get his pseudonym from?
So Engelbert Humperdinck was a German composer in the 19th century who he composed the Hansel and Gretel opera. So there we go. So yeah, he wasn't getting much success in the music industry apparently. So somebody said change the name. So, yeah, a bit like, what was Elton John's? Reginald White. Yeah, come on. That
Reginald White,
like a
rock star. Yeah, I kind of...
Elton John sounds better. And well, again, coming on stage, it's Arnold Dorsey. Okay.
Arnold
coming on
Dorsey.
Stage, it's Engelbert Humperdinck. And especially back in the day, you know, it's going to make people take notice, right? But
well, it did. I can only think of Please Release Me. Oh, and The Last Waltz was Engelbert Humperdinck, wasn't it? The Last Waltz, which is played at Priestfield whenever Gillingham win.
Is that right? You know what? Release Me is the only one I could have named. But Wikipedia tells me he sold 140 million records. But there we go. I know. Yeah. Anyway,
yeah, The Last Waltz is like Gillingham's song. It's sort of...
okay.
It's what the fans sing when we're winning. Apparently, I mean, I can't remember the last time of the Gillingham game when we were winning. But yeah, and apparently, if we ever win... We've only won one game on a Saturday this season. But apparently, when we do win... They play. That's what they play for the Tannoy still. So yeah, Engelbert Humperdinck.
And don't talk to me about fans singing because this Saturday is going to be my comeback game at Hillsborough. So four times I've wanted to go this season. First one was at Sunderland at home. I've been to see Wednesday play away this year once, but Sunderland at home postponed for international call ups. Them, not us. I was going to go to, I think it's the Lincoln game. I injured my leg. I wanted to go to the Gillingham game. We mentioned that. And
yes.
And then my work all day, Saturday, all day training session. And then this Saturday, I've actually got further and actually bought train tickets and the match tickets, non-refundable, of course. And yeah, today it was called off due to a COVID outbreak within the club. So I'm absolutely devastated because I'm chomping at the bit.
So you've still got a train ticket to Sheffield for Saturday?
You know what? I was thinking, because I thought I could get quite a few good comedy TikToks out, because I don't know if you ever watch any, but a lot of them involve slagging off Sheffield United. So I thought I could get up there. Bramall Lane's pretty close to the city centre. Go yes. out, film a few TikToks outside Bramall Lane for comedy purposes. But do I really want to spend the whole day on... I mean, because given the tickets I've got, I'll be leaving home at 9 o'clock. And coming back at 10:30. So just to clarify for people who don't know where Kent to Sheffield is, that's 9 a.m. coming back at 10:30 p.m. It's a long distance to go just to film some TikToks.
I once stayed in the hotel at Bramall Lane when I was up there for the World Snooker Championship a few years ago. I stayed at the hotel at Bramall Lane. I was in like a cop fawn or something. Got up the next morning, opened the windows and was overlooking the pitch.
Oh, really?
There's a few grounds like that. I Bolton's definitely one. There's a few grounds like when they're not playing at home, they convert them into hotel rooms.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I have been to Bramall Lane to watch football, but, yeah, I don't think you can open your curtains in your hotel room and there's a game going on. I don't think that would ever happen. But yeah, when there's nothing going on.
Unlike the Toronto Blue Jays, there's a famous picture there of the hotel overlooking the stadium. And well, I don't know, what would we say? An amorous couple or... that's probably how to say it in newspaper speak, right? They
depends which newspaper.
They didn't care. Yeah, this is true. This is true. Or they didn't care. Or I don't know, maybe the Sun will call it a two in a bed romp. But there is during the game. Lots of pictures on Google. You can find it for yourself.
Okay. Maybe a late evening after recording. But yeah, okay. There was none of that going on when I opened my curtains, to be honest.
Fair enough. You do want to passionate anyway. Love overlooking Bramble Lane.
No, I mean, you didn't see the person I was sharing the room with.
Fair enough.
Anyway, Engelbert Humperdinck, well done.
Yeah, so bizarre fan. I mean, I think he's more bizarre because I think it's he's not a regular, but he has been pictured in a Leicester shirt. He has over the years, you know, like, sends his best wishes to the teams, and I don't think he's a hard. I don't think he's got a fox tattooed on his arm. Let's put it that way. But he's a fan. He's from the area, and I think he's more bizarre just because of his name and his face.
Yes, he has got a bizarre face. Okay, Engelbert. Right,
harsh. Anyway, there we go. Fact number three.
Fact number three is one of my favourites so far. In the 1954 game between Chelsea and Leicester City, Leicester City's Stan Milburn and Jack Froggatt scored, for the only time in Football League history, a goal that was credited to two players.
Oh, my word.
That's pretty amazing. Now, it was an own goal. It was an own goal. And it was the only time in Football League history that a shared goal has been scored.
Oh, okay. Wow. Because, so they gave one to the... Go on.
Well, they were both Leicester City players and it was an own goal, but apparently it hit both of them simultaneously and went in. And they could... And I mean, clearly, that sort of thing has happened on other occasions, hasn't it? But someone always gets credited with the goal. On this occasion, for some reason, they both got credited with it as a shared goal. And that's never happened before or after.
I suppose it's never going to happen because, like you say, nowadays they've got the committee that sits there and decides who gets each goal. It's like the 10 points must system in boxing. You've got to choose a winner. It doesn't matter what happens. You've got to give a 10-9 one way or the other, unless you're Carl Froch, who scores every other round 10-10 on Sky. But you have to give it one way or the other. So it's probably not going to happen again, is it?
Well, the only other circumstance similar I could find was there was a goal in a cup final in the 1870s scored by, I think, the Royal Engineers that isn't credited to anyone because they don't know who scored it. Apparently, it was just like a big, basically a bundle in the penalty area and the ball ended up in the goal and they don't know who scored it, so it wasn't credited to anyone.
They didn't have Hawkeye back then.
Well, no, really. Well, yeah. It was someone drawing a sketch was Hawkeye back then, and it was like we can't wait for this, can we? But I think there must be occasions, even with with slow motion, blah blah blah, whatever, that the ball must hit two players at the same time and go in.
You'd surely, think so, wouldn't you?
Surely it must happen. It's like in cricket, you sometimes see with like bat pad, it sort of hits bat pad simultaneously, doesn't it? And then it's very hard to tell whether it's legit LBW call or not. But there must be times where like both players head the ball at the same time and it goes in.
Surely. Right, yeah, it must have happened. It must have. I mean, how do you decide then if you are that Premier League committee who sits down and meets and says, no, I think we need to give that goal to that person or that person. How do you decide?
The dubious goals panel. This is, isn't it? Yeah. You got to choose one.
Is that their name?
Yeah, the dubious goals panel. Yeah, they're like small-time ex-footballers, I think, and ex-referees or something. But anyway, they you get together and decide because obviously, to the individual players, it's quite important. But there is always, whenever a goal is scored, no matter how dubious it is, there is always someone laying claim to it, isn't there? No matter how legitimate that claim is, there is always someone who wheels away in celebration, just because, even when it's an own goal, you do quite often think of own goals, there's still someone trying to claim it, isn't there? Even though, just because they were like in the vicinity when it went in.
David Nugent.
David Nugent was a legit strike.
Right.
In fact, I'd argue that David Nugent's goal was a thunderbolt. He did absolutely blast it in, didn't he?
Almost broke the net.
Yeah, well, my favourite ones are when there's like a ridiculous deflected strike and they still celebrate as if they've like banged in a 30-yarder. It's like, you weren't even trying to shoot then, mate, were you? And you... It's like West Ham player did one last week against Chelsea and they celebrated as if they'd like banged in a 30-yarder and it was just a fluke, basically.
To be fair. Oh, that one. Yeah, I mean, wasn't it a last-minute winner for West Ham against Chelsea? Come on, you're going to celebrate that one, aren't you?
Yeah, I suppose. But it's like, it's just the way they celebrate as if they've done something amazing. But yeah, I suppose it's quite exciting. And don't get me wrong, if I scored a goal in the Premier League, I wouldn't give a shit how it went in. I'd be like, I'd be full length for the pitch, Emmanuel Adebayor style celebrating. But yeah, Stan Milburn and Jack Crawford. Okay, here's a question for you. Yeah.
Can I interrupt? You say, like, if you were playing, imagine you're in your prime footballing career. You play for, let's say, a dominant team, Manchester United in 1995. So Alex Ferguson puts you up front and builds the team around you. Okay, so you can take penalties, free kicks. How many goals could you get in a season?
I reckon I'd get 6 in that season.
The whole team, like, forget the championship, guys, got to get Simon to score whatever they can, like, you know, however you make your runs into the box, they're going to aim for that your special place within the 6-yard box. It's all about you. Okay, you think you're knocking 6 seems reasonable.
I think I'd be pretty easy to mark for start, but I would fancy my chances of a penalty. I reckon, let's say over the course of the season, United got 6 to 8 penalties. It was probably more back then, wasn't it? I reckon I'd score a third of them.
Okay.
I'm all right at penalties. I mean, I don't know why you bothered mentioning free kicks. I mean, is there any hope in how? Oh, yeah, because that gave me a great chance of bending in like a 30-yarder against a Premier League goalkeeper.
Maybe if the keeper picked up a back pass and it was 3 yards out and you just had to have one where you just blasted it and hoped it took a lucky deflection. Maybe you could get that one.
And obviously the fact that I'd be up front and I'd be in the penalty area might mean that I get a bit of luck, like a rebound or something, a couple of times a season. So I reckon I could get 6 goals without actually finishing off a move deliberately, because I don't think that's going to happen. Right. I think A, I'd never be in the right position, and B, I'd be easily marked. I just feel like, although having said that, why would the opposition bother marking me? Why would you waste the player on marking me? That seems
After a few weeks, I suppose if Sir Alex built the team around you, the opponents would get cute to that and just mark you all the time.
When you say build the team around me, is it like Cantona's threw on goal but he refuses to shoot? Because he just wants
I think in that case, we're not going to go completely ridiculous. I think, in that case, Cantona can finish it off, but in all other circumstances, it's about get the ball today, play day 3.
Yeah, I'm 10-6.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I'm 10-6.
You're going 6. Interesting.
Well, for a start, all these goals have got to be in the first 20 minutes, for a start, because after 20 minutes, I'm like, I'm done. So, I mean, because I ain't getting in the right position, am I? I mean, early doors, I might be able to sort of bust a gut and get into the penalty area, but the rest of the time, I'm not going to be in the right position.
You'd dive a lot, I imagine. Like the ball would come to you in the area. The second a defender went near, you'd throw yourself to the ground. Penalty.
Yes.
You'd probably get a couple as well, wouldn't you? I mean, at Old Trafford.
At Old Trafford, in the mid-90s, it was fair game, wasn't it? I reckon I'll get a few penalties. I'll probably pick up a few bookings as well for that, for simulation. But 6, I'm saying. 6.
Okay, right. Well, you heard it here. Anyway, Mr. Day, some good facts there. Some good facts. Yes. I like that. So what facts have we got? By the way, did you like the media from the Leeds United one? I thought that was our most bizarre one yet.
It was Tampax
And just George Best lying in agony as Leeds players kind of standing around. I thought that was a good one here. But I think we've got plenty to play with, whether it's Barry Lineker's greengrocer shop or your face superimposed over Andy Cole, over Andy Cole's body, like scoring at Old Trafford, or me going to prison because I stole a Gary Megson card. I mean, there's a lot to unpick here. But anyway, some solid facts in here. What are we thinking about Leicester City? They've definitely not taken Everton's title. Have they taken Crystal Palace's title as the most interesting team in football?
In my opinion, yes.
Okay. And you know what? I think we've probably gone on long. And I noticed Crystal Palace is our longest one yet, isn't it?
Oh, is it? Okay. This might be beating
it. And
that
probably says something. And I think this one might be beating it. I think Leicester have been, they've given us plenty to talk about. Admittedly, Gary Megson and you scoring at Old Trafford kind of went on a bit long. You know, like, I don't know whether we can really give the credit to Leicester, but they're good facts, right?
Solid facts. And like I've said, Leicester winning the league title is the most interesting thing that's happened in football.
Yeah, that's a good shout. That's a good shout. I feel like I've let the side down for Engelbert Humperdinck. He's a bizarre fan, but we bring him up every single. He's a legend of the Interesting Football Podcast, but we can't not mention Osama bin Laden when it comes to the bizarre fan. It's just a given. I'm sorry to the three loyal listeners.
I think for the first time in history,
James McQueen, Paul, Addy, and Addy. Sorry.
Addy. I think for the first time in history, we can say Engelbert Humperdinck is now Osama bin Laden.
We can indeed. So, okay, I'm with you there. Leicester City are now the most interesting club. The lineal title has moved from Arsenal to Crystal Palace to Leicester City. Fantastic scenes here. Right, Mr. Day, next week it's going to be Liverpool.
Yeah, I don't like them.
Am I right?
Yeah, it is. I don't like them.
Lots of potential. Obviously, a storied club. Lots of history there. I think we've got a lot to go through. Liverpool, Leicester, it could be a short reign, but there we go. We'll see. So, Mr. Day, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yes, I've thoroughly enjoyed that.
Me too. Right. Thank you very much. And I will see you next week. Bye-bye, everyone.